Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to begin first with the double jeopardy issue, and to emphasize that for two independent, separate reasons, double jeopardy does not apply. The first is that Ward delayed bringing his constitutional challenge until after jeopardy attached, and the second is that double jeopardy applies only when a defendant is deemed factually not guilty, not as here when the defendant was deemed legally not guilty. So as for the first reason, this past June, the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed in Currier against Virginia that double jeopardy, quote, does not relieve a defendant from the consequences of his voluntary choice. The court there faced a situation where the defendant was charged with burglary and with possessing firearms during the burglary. The defendant elected to sever both those charges into two different trials and was acquitted of the burglary trial, of the burglary charge. The defendant asserted that double jeopardy prohibited the second trial because he could not be guilty of possessing firearms during a burglary if he did not, in fact, commit the burglary. But the U.S. Supreme Court said no. Double jeopardy did not apply because the defendant had elected to sever the two charges into two different trials. The same principle applies here. There's no dispute that if Ward had brought his constitutional challenge pre-trial, the government could have appealed from an adverse decision with double jeopardy never entering the equation.
You've raised several cases from the Court of Appeals that says a motion to dismiss is the proper place to bring the constitutional challenge. But there are many cases from this court that do not hold a defendant to that standard, aren't there?
Well, regardless, in any circumstance, the delay of bringing that challenge is a voluntary choice by the defendant.
There's a huge distinction between raising a defense and electing a procedural posture.
Let me discuss this, the U.S. Supreme Court's case in Lee against United States, which I think is directly on point. There the defendant elected to bring his motion to dismiss later in the game, which the U.S. Supreme Court said, quote, virtually assured attachment of jeopardy, which is basically what occurred here. He raised his constitutional challenge after jeopardy had attached.
But if the court would have entered a dismissal versus a not guilty finding in the judgment, the state would still have had the opportunity to appeal, even if it had been following a jury trial. Isn't that your position?
That is the second reason why double jeopardy does not apply.
But that's my point, is like the defendant didn't choose to waive this argument because the court could have issued a dismissal instead of a not guilty finding. If your theory is correct.
Choice here is the choice to delay bringing the constitutional challenge until after jeopardy attached.
But the point being made by Judge Powell is that the delay is not the reason that, if there is a reason double jeopardy attaches, the delay is not the reason, because even given the delay, the court could have just dismissed it later. As earlier, if the court had just granted a motion to dismiss early or late, wouldn't have made any difference.
I agree it wouldn't have made any difference. That goes to our second independent reason why double jeopardy.
It goes to both, but go ahead to the second.
It does go to both.
To the second reason.
So as to that second reason, the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly made clear that double jeopardy applies only when a person is deemed factually not guilty, not when the person is deemed legally not guilty. U.S. against Scott is basically the landmark case for this proposition. There, the court held that double jeopardy does not apply if the order rests, quote, on any ground other than the insufficiency of the evidence. And then later in footnote 11, the court said that an order is not even an acquittal for double jeopardy purposes if the order is, quote, unrelated to factual guilt or innocence.
Well, I guess the concern here is that why do you think that there wasn't a factual finding in this case? What's your basis for thinking that?
Well, there were factual findings here. Here, the facts have been undisputed the entire time. In fact, in the judgment, the court rehashes the facts, basically finds that the defendant did actually commit the act, and then the sole reason the court issues the not guilty judgment is because of the court's determination that the statute was unconstitutionally overbroad.
Opposing party says that one of the reasons they asked for a not guilty finding was the evidence was insufficient. So how do you know that the trial court made this legal finding versus this factual finding?
I have two responses to that, Judge Powell. One, respectfully, I think that that argument misstates the record. I'll point the court to the very first line of defendant's suggestions in opposition below. There, the defendant said, "The question in this case has never been whether the conduct alleged occurred. The question is whether that conduct is illegal. It's always been undisputed that all the acts necessary to find Ward factually guilty did in fact occur." Their entire argument below was whether this was unconstitutional. Now, my second response to your argument, Your Honor, is that even if further factual proceedings were necessary, double jeopardy still would not apply. So in the U.S. against Jenkins case in 1976, the U.S. Supreme Court said further factual proceedings would be a bar to re-prosecution, would be a bar to an appeal. But 3 years later in U.S. against Scott, the Supreme Court expressly overruled that case and made clear that double jeopardy applies only if a court affirmatively makes factual findings in favor of the defendant that would preclude guilt. So even if this court doesn't believe that the court made any factual findings, the court certainly did not make factual findings in the defendant's favor.
Well, how do you know? I mean, he entered a not guilty verdict. If let's say the judgment didn't recite any of the language with respect to the statute being unconstitutionally overbroad, and just said defendant is not guilty, cost to Polk County, case and record ordered closed, there would be no argument, right?
There absolutely would be an argument, because there the court would not have evinced anything in the record that would have said that the court affirmatively found facts in the defendant's favor that precluded legal guilt.
But we don't require in a court-tried case that the court make factual findings as to each element of the offense.
Why wouldn't the facts be found in accordance with the judgment?
Well, here, that's not.
I understand that's not the record here, but yeah. In his hypothetical, why wouldn't the facts have been found in accordance with the judgment?
I mean, there it might be a closer case, because you wouldn't have had a determination, as you have here, that the court's basis was legal, that the court's basis was on the court's determination that the statute was unconstitutional. So that might be a more difficult case, but that's not the case we're presented with here. It's plain and indisputable from the judgment that the trial court issued its opinion based on its determination that the statute was unconstitutional.
Can you tell us the language you rely on in the court's judgment or in its statement at the time of the judgment?
The court first finds, and again, this is, I believe this is docket 21 or 22, the court rehashes the statements. The court rehashes the defendant's age. The court rehashes the victim's age, says that all, quote, all was consensual, so they engaged in the acts that the stipulated facts said they engaged in. And then the court said, in this factual situation, the statute is unconstitutionally overbroad, and it cited the State against Biney case. It's a very brief order. There's no indication whatsoever that the court found any facts in favor of the defendant that would have precluded legal guilt. It was entirely a legal determination about the constitutionality of that statute.
Did they file a motion to dismiss for lack of sufficient evidence?
No, they did not.
Judgment of acquittal? Okay.
Correct.
The briefing that was filed by the defendant after the case was submitted to the court and taken under advisement indicated that one of the reasons that the defense asked for a not guilty verdict was because the state hadn't proven all the elements of the offense, specifically the element that the defendant did this with the purpose of gratifying his sexual desires.
Well, this court has already answered that, and I think that's really a legal argument. That's not a factual argument, despite how the defendant dressed up that argument. In the State against Miller case that this court decided in 2012, the individual charged under the same statute argued that there's no sufficient evidence of his guilt because he argued that he hadn't exposed himself for sexual gratification. He had instead exposed himself to engage in a sexual act. And this court said, well, if there's a sexual act that takes place, then exposure being necessary to that sexual act, the exposure is, in fact, done for the purposes of sexual gratification. So this attempt to try to split these.
But doesn't Sabrina say that if you make a legal finding in order to find a not guilty, even if the legal finding is incorrect, that it's still, as long as there's acquittal, a not guilty finding, then double jeopardy attaches?
Not at all, Your Honor. The court expressly said in Sanabria that the case was a case about the insufficiency of the evidence. So the court there did make a legal error, but the legal error it made caused it to exclude evidence leading to an insufficiency of the evidence finding, an express insufficiency of the evidence finding, and that's how the Supreme Court characterized that case, was a case about insufficiency of the evidence. That's not what we have here. Here, it's always been undisputed, as the defendant's very first line of their suggestions in opposition state, that he committed all the acts necessary for factual guilt. They only contested, quote, the question is whether that conduct is illegal. They contested the constitutionality of the statute itself. That was it. Now, I'll briefly get into the merits, unless the court has further questions on this issue. Ward has agreed that the overbreadth doctrine does not apply here. So he makes a statutory argument and a constitutional argument, and neither one prevails. So the statutory argument is that because there's no statute that prohibited the sexual act involved, then the state could not enforce an ancillary statute, a statute that prohibited exposure, which was necessary to engage in the sexual act. But that's a lot like saying that because the court does not prohibit drug use, it also cannot enforce statutes against drug prohibition or drug possession, because possession is necessary for use. So I think the logic there just plainly does not apply. So he's left with this constitutional argument that Lawrence against Texas created a right to privacy in this situation. But there's no court that's ever held that there's a substantive due process right to for an adult to have sexual relations with a child. And this court need not be the first to do so. And in fact, the Lawrence against Texas case expressly disclaimed that its privacy ruling had anything to do with minors. That comes on page 578 of that opinion. So I think the merits argument plainly fails, and it's really just this double jeopardy issue. And for those two reasons we've stated above, double jeopardy does not apply. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Your Honors, Judge Roberts did not say in his order, guilty but unconstitutional. He said, not guilty and unconstitutional. On the one hand, the state has argued that this is, in actuality, a dismissal, not a not guilty finding, and therefore they have the right to appeal it. But on the other hand, they fault us for not filing a pretrial motion to dismiss. But what counsel did in this case was ask for an acquittal on the facts. Mr. Devine read to you the first part of defense counsel's suggestions filed as a closing argument, and I'd like to read a bit of the last paragraph. The last paragraph says, in closing, defendant should be found not guilty. Defendant's exposure of his genitals, MPB, was not for the purpose of gratifying his sexual desires. It was for the purpose of engaging in a consensual sexual encounter that is not prohibited by law.
Why does what either of the lawyers said in argument make any difference to the resolution of this case? And why isn't this case resolved specifically on a review of the stipulated facts from the parties?
I think because of Judge Roberts' findings, Your Honor. The parties did not stipulate.
Well, when the parties stipulate to the facts, how can the judge make any finding apart from the stipulation?
Because there's two elements to this offense. Mr. Devine seems to think that the for purposes of sexual gratification is subsumed by the sexual act itself, and it's not. It's a separate element of this crime that was one that was not stipulated to.
Aren't you asking them to stop right at the point where he exposes his penis and not look at the purpose for which he does so, which is to engage in the sex act, which you're not claiming is not for sexual gratification? So, Rick, responding to opposing counsel's point, you can't stop it and say you're not guilty of in possession. Of course, you have to use something. That you can't separate out each little one and say, okay, is this a crime, is this a crime, is this a crime? And looking at the purpose for which he exposed himself, you look at the entire conduct. And how, if he says he did it for the purpose of engaging in sexual activity, how is that not for the purpose of sexual gratification?
I think it's just one step too far to assume from those facts and that stipulation.
It's not an assumption. It's from what he said. If he said, I did it for the purpose of engaging in sexual activity, tell me how anyone could find, how is that not an admission? It was for the purpose of sexual gratification.
It's a really close question, Your Honor, and I appreciate that. But it's still a legal determination that has to be made from that I was having sex with her to this exposure was for the purpose of sexual gratification, because it wasn't, which is why we've cited the Biney case. It's very analogous.
But it was so he could engage in the sexual activity. You can't. It's not because he was going to the bathroom in, like, their earlier case or some other reason, or he was changing clothes. It was so he could engage in sex.
Right, but I don't think you can take an element of a crime and say we're going to assume that that elements of this crime is met because obviously it was. You've still got to have a factual finding, and when you've got a not guilty verdict, we look at those facts in the light most favorable to the verdict. You can't make that leap factually because you're making it you're making a legal leap instead of a factual one.
Well, and don't our cases say that the court and the jury is free to believe or disbelieve any of the evidence submitted to the court?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And so Judge Roberts, even if all this was stipulated, could just not believe it. He could believe that this child was 35 years old.
This case shouldn't be looked at in any differently just because it's stipulated facts than if all of these witnesses had testified.
Well, I want to ask you a question about that, because this wasn't a case where the parties stipulated as to what the judge could consider, like, I stipulate to these reports. This was a case where the parties set out stipulated facts, much like you would in a motion for summary judgment.
That's correct.
So that's what I don't understand, why both parties wouldn't be bound by the facts as stipulated, and the rare case where the judge wouldn't have any discretion in how to find the facts, but only how the law would apply to the facts.
I think the lack in that stipulation, Your Honor, is the for purposes of sexual gratification. What they say is they attach all of the probable cause statement. They attach all of the statements of both of the teenagers. They attach everything, and they talk about what they did. He never says it was for the purpose. The exposure was for the purpose of sexual gratification. It's an element of the crime,
right,
that Judge Roberts found.
I understand. And maybe I'm not making myself clear. Is there a difference procedurally between situations where lawyers stipulate as to what the evidence is and then give a stack of stuff to the judge, as opposed to when lawyers actually stipulate as to what the facts are and ask the judge to make a decision based upon those facts? And this may be part of that, it may be all of that, but which is it?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think we're splitting hairs. I don't see that, maybe if this had been entitled stipulation of evidence rather than stipulation of facts, we might have a little clearer case.
Well, which do you think it was? Did the parties stipulate to every fact that's contained in everything that was presented to the judge? Or did they just stipulate that the judge could consider all these things as evidence?
The stipulation is titled Stipulation of Facts. And it says stipulate to the following facts, records, and admission of evidence. The facts that were stipulated to are the ages of the children and some of the activities that occurred, and then it goes on to say the court shall admit into evidence the probable cause statement.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's
a little of both.
Right. So now you've answered my question, at least the way I thought that I read the record. This is both. This
I think
is
it's a
little
of both.
Here are the facts we stipulate to, and judge, here's the rest of everything else that you can consider in making your decision.
I think you're right, Your Honor. I'm sorry I didn't understand your question at first.
Your stipulation didn't address the purpose of the disclosure. The stipulation didn't address whether it was for sexual gratification.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. That I think if that would be included in the statement of the defendant, which would be part of the evidence presented to Judge Roberts. And as Judge Powell pointed out, he's free to believe or disbelieve anything he wants. There's no specific stipulation that this was for purposes of sexual gratification, so it is a fact.
Is there a stipulation that it was for purposes of engaging in fellatio or...
No, they say that occurred, but they don't say what the purpose of the exposure was.
And how do you respond to the Santa Maria case by the U.S. Supreme Court? The state argues that that is, appears to be arguing that's binding precedent. What's your response to that?
I think Santa Maria is in our favor, frankly. It says that appeal by the state is barred even where legal rulings underlying the acquittal were erroneous. So I think if this court wants to get into the weeds of Biney, which is, as you know, a sort of a convoluted case anymore, or my substantive due process argument, which I fully concede was unpreserved below, I think Santa Maria bars appeal by the state under this circumstance because of the factual not guilty finding.
The Santa Maria, the legal issue where the court said the trial court got wrong was an evidentiary ruling, and the legal evidentiary ruling led the court to make an improper factual finding. So the dismissal of the case or the acquittal of the defendant in Santa Maria was based on actual factual findings, not a legal reason. It's just that the facts didn't include maybe all the facts the trial court should have considered. So isn't that distinguished from this case?
Yeah, I think we're in a better shape because what we've got are factual, what we've got is a sufficiency case. We've got the state appealing a sufficiency case. We don't have an acquittal entered in the middle of a case because of a mistaken evidentiary ruling. We've got a judge that heard all of the evidence and decided to enter a not guilty verdict.
But they say, and it's if you read the judgment, it seems pretty clear that what the judge was doing is saying that the charge was unconstitutionally overbroad and really wasn't making factual findings, but merely was just saying that this he should never have been charged.
But the judge clearly does not make a finding on the element that we're disputing. I don't know what this court is going to do if it reverses. Are you going to remand and order Judge Roberts to enter a guilty verdict?
Well, I was going to ask your opposing counsel what he thought the appropriate relief was.
I can't see a situation that works. Are you going to order him to sentence my client on the not guilty verdict if you reverse?
Or order him to enter
a guilty verdict?
Or maybe that's why it matters whether this case is a pure stipulation of facts or whether or not it was certain facts stipulated and certain facts tried.
I think from what we parsed out from the record earlier, Your Honor, it's certain facts were tried as well.
If the trial judge had put dismissed at the bottom of his order, would you have the same difficulty?
I would not. The state clearly can appeal dismissals. Okay.
So the question, it seems, is what is it that the trial court did? And I've heard of judgments of conviction and sentence. I've heard of judgments of acquittal. I'm not clear about judgments of not guilty. Is there such a thing?
I think it's a verdict. I don't think it's
a lot of verdicts entered in bench trials?
I have seen written verdicts in bench trials. A lot of times the judge will just announce
it. But that then gets incorporated into a judgment.
I don't know that they often enter a formal judgment after a bench trial verdict if not guilty. I frankly haven't seen a lot of.
Well, what was the motion that you made?
The motion, I've got it right here. It's not a motion. It's entitled suggestions. Defendant's closing argument and suggestions. That's what the state filed as well. They both filed what was called a written closing argument.
And what was the action you were asking the court to do?
The prayer is defendant should be found not guilty. That's the final line of the motion. It doesn't say this should be dismissed.
And you're happy with the position that ends the case and it doesn't require a judgment of acquittal?
I mean, normally a judgment of acquittal is after a jury verdict or in the middle of a jury trial. I've seen bench trials end all sorts of ways. Usually they end with a guilty verdict, frankly. I'm not sure.
End the case? No, there has to be a judgment of conviction and sentence.
Because they sentence the defendant at that point. That's when they enter a formal judgment is when at sentencing. But I don't know. This entitled judgment... Judge Roberts' order is entitled judgment. And it has costs and orders the record closed. So I guess in that sense, it's definitely a judgment.
We all agree if it had said guilty and the sentence is X, or if it had said acquittal in the last line, or if it had said dismissed in the last line.
Why is
all of
it
those
not
judgments
guilty?
Would be easy for us to resolve.
Right.
This one is, by virtue of the last sentence, more difficult.
It's very messy, and it's in a sense it's like Biney, which held the statute unconstitutional at the same time saying the evidence was insufficient. You know, Biney's been essentially overruled as to the constitutional part of it, but the sufficiency claim in that case is still alive, and this is very similar.
The trial court not only found the defendant not guilty, but it assessed costs to Polk County and ordered the case and record closed. Assessing costs to the county and closing the record would in fact only be done if the court had entered a judgment to the defendant. So without the language, it's entering a judgment of acquittal. It's the context of what it did indicates it was entering a judgment of acquittal.
I agree with you, Your Honor. It's sort of a verdict and a judgment in the same.
Why do we have to guess, though? Why can't we ask the trial court to clarify whether it was dismissing the charge or entering a judgment of acquittal? Why in this circumstance do we have to guess?
I mean, that would answer my question, Judge Wilson, about what you would be remanding for. I think that this is clearly a not guilty. Because the judge doesn't find an element of the offense, which is, I think you have to read defense counsel's motion in conjunction with this judgment, where he says there is not evidence of the gratifying sexual desire element and asks that the defendant
but
be found not guilty.
Here's my question again. This is just closing argument. We don't review sufficiency of the evidence based on lawyers' closing arguments.
We kind of look at
the record and see what was stipulated into and see what the evidence was. And generally, we determine that the evidence was found in accordance with the judgment.
And we don't typically find that something, a statute's unconstitutionally overbroad to the facts of this case and then find that the facts were insufficient. It's unconstitutional. So that's a legal issue, not a factual issue.
And it's not an as-applied thing. If it's overbroad, it would be as a whole.
Face.
Right. And my Biney argument is sort of
separate
than this. I think Judge Roberts made a factual determination of not guilty based on the stipulation, which includes evidence presented to him, and you have to review that in the light most favorable to the verdict.
But if it's a factual finding, why did he say unconstitutionally overbroad? That's a legal argument, right?
It's surplusage, Judge. It really is. As I started out, he doesn't say guilty but unconstitutional.
No,
he says not guilty and.
The only thing I can think of that would be analogous would be if you had a jury trial where the court possibly took the motion with the case, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty, and the judge decided as well to say that he'd found the and his taking the motion with the case somehow found that the statute was also overbroad and unconstitutional. So then you'd have both. You'd have the verdict of not guilty by a jury, and you'd have a constitutional legal ruling by the court, both at the same time.
And in that situation,
this case,
go ahead, Judge.
Judge Sid made specific statements as to why he found the verdict of not guilty, which the jury would have found in a jury trial case.
Right. And under the statute that governs states' appeals, they would have been unable to appeal that because double jeopardy would lie.
You haven't had a chance to address, and your time is up, but just very quickly, if this court were to find it could reach the merits of the claims raised by the state, you were arguing that if you cannot be convicted of rape or sodomy, then you can't be convicted of the offense of exposing yourself to a minor?
I think under Biney, which held on the sufficiency claim in Biney, that is still good law, that exposing your genitals was incidental to the lawful act of public urination, so exposing genitals was incidental.
But could the legislature, I mean, it'd be a stupid thing to do, but could they pass a law precluding public urination, and then you could violate that even though you didn't commit some greater crime of intending to expose yourself?
I mean, I think we would.
I mean, that's what they did
here. I think
here.
We would segue into my third point, then, Your Honor, which is there still exists in this country a constitutional right to privacy. It's been narrowed a lot, but it goes all the way back to the
state. And that precludes the state from barring you from exposing yourself to a minor?
This is not a case like this court had that Jeffrey case, and it was actually also my case, where the fellow was standing in his storm door while little girls got on the school bus exposing himself. This is constitutionally protected activity.
Why? Would that be and not the other? Would this be and not that case?
I'm frankly offended by the charge the state brought in this case. This is two teenagers. We may not approve of what they were doing, but this was not unlawful behavior.
Well, there's a difference between it being not unlawful and it being constitutionally protected. If the state could make it a crime for an 18-year-old to have sex with a 14-year-old.
They could. They absolutely
and so that
could,
means it's not constitutionally protected. They just have chosen not to make that a crime.
And
They chose to make a lesser crime of exposing yourself to a minor. I'm not understanding, if it's not a privacy issue, why they can't choose to do that. Double jeopardy does not preclude them from having the same conduct, violate or not violate lots of different offenses. The same conduct may violate one law and not another law. It may violate four different laws. That's okay for double jeopardy purposes. They get to divide up the laws and what you can be convicted of.
I think what Judge Roberts did here may have been akin to jury nullification, but he had the right to do that. If he found factually that this conduct did not meet the elements of this offense, then he had the right to enter this not guilty verdict.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to make two main points in response. One, this notion that the phrase not guilty has some kind of talismanic meaning has been repeatedly repeated not only by this court but by the U.S. Supreme Court. In the Sanabria case and the Martin Linden Supply case, the court repeatedly said that it is not the characterization of the judgment that matters, it is the actual legal effect. My second main point is...
But by saying not guilty and taxing costs against the county and closing the file, closing the case, why isn't that the effect of an acquittal?
Well, because courts tax costs all the time, and then people sometimes bring a petition for certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court, which keeps the case going, and sometimes the U.S. Supreme Court reverses. A case is final if you don't appeal it, and so it was fine for the court to tax costs in this circumstances, because if the state didn't appeal...
The court could have taxed costs and closed the file if it had been a judgment of dismissal.
Right, exactly. The second main point I want to make, that early in opposing counsel's argument, she said that the trial court did not make a finding on the disputed issue. This is very much like the U.S. against Scott case. There, the U.S. Supreme Court observed that the trial court did not make any factual findings whatsoever. The record was silent as to whether the court made any factual findings. And the court said there's no double jeopardy issue if they had to remand for further factual proceedings. Now, we think the court did make all the factual findings necessary. Again, this is a stipulated case. It's somewhat unusual. And so we think that this court should require the trial court to issue a guilty verdict. But even if this court disagrees, U.S. against Scott is firmly on all fours with this case. This court could remand for further factual proceedings. It need not, because the court found all the facts, but this court could do that. And I want to briefly address the statutory argument. If the victim was just a couple months younger, if she were 13 instead of 14, then under Section 566.032, he would have been subject to a 5-year mandatory minimum. Now, it's pretty reasonable for a legislature to decide that's not going to go from a 5-year mandatory minimum all the way to zero. It has this in-between stage, which is this exposure statute, which has a max provision of 4 years and could go, you know, all the way down to zero, probation, other different types of sentences. But if the court has no further questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you. It was a well-argued case.